Hey, pants people! I just want to take a quick second here to bend your proverbial ear, or proverbially bend your actual ear? I don't care. This episode and this podcast is a huge, huge pride point for all of us here. Now, I know we aren't exactly a big fish in the podcast sea, or like even a regular-sized fish. We're a minnow, damn it. But we're a minnow with 100 main episodes that we've had a blast recording, and with an incredible community of folks that have become a part of the story of Fantasy Pants, as well as the story of Fantasy Pants, if you know what I mean. Seriously, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you all for listening and for believing in the little podcast that could. Now gird your loins, one and all, for episode 100 of Fantasy Pants.
For many, many years now. I've had the honor of sharing with y'all so many incredible things. We've seen the rise of new brave souls stepping into the role of luminary adventurers. We've seen the end of Taib's civil war and the revolution of the downtrodden on San Sebastian, worlds shaped by the deeds of the righteous and the kind. But there has been tragedy too. Tythos ever hangs on our hearts. I'm getting distracted though. What I really mean to say is, thank you. Seriously, thank you. Every one of you listen to me now, every one of you that has heard my stories and followed my words, our worlds are filled with incredible folk doing incredible things. But outside of their direct effects, these acts amount to little without being heard. They inspire nothing, and they fade away. By tuning into our show, you're spreading the word, and you're giving a second life to these stories. So, yeah, thank you all. So much. Anyway, we should really get on to our next story.
For a minute there, I thought you were going to say, like, I want to thank you all, but I'm retiring.
Oh, there's twists to come in episode 100, but that's not one of them. Episode 100!
New theme song!
New theme song!
New theme song!
Yes!
This calls for a fear-abration.
Already open my thing. Hey, oh, sorry.
Jesus
Whoa,
Christ,
easy
David.
There.
Hey. Prost.
Prost.
Yeah, we did it.
100, baby.
What a wild day. And actually, after this, we're going to wrap up episode 100. We're going to go home to our separate lives. Jeremy's going to stay here because it is home.
Yeah. I'm already in my and, PJs, man.
We're going to jump into an interview with Hunter.
We mentioned
that's
before. Gonna be super cool.
Hunter
yeah.
has a couple of shows. What we didn't mention was it one of his shows, his third show or fourth or fifth. This guy's crazy busy. He does interviews. And we're on one. So what a wild night this is going to be. And what's the name of the show? What's the name of Hunter's show?
Yes, Hunter's interview show, Over the Table.
Over the Table, yes. Okay, tip my tongue. Yes.
We'll be recording that tonight. We don't know exactly when it's going to come out, but stay tuned, watch our spaces, and we'll share it with you.
Yeah, hell yeah. And thank you again, Hunter. Can't wait to talk to you later. Or a few weeks ago, or some time ago. I don't know what this lines up with when you're listening to the show when we're talking. Anyway, yeah.
It's all relative, man.
Time is relative.
Time is weird.
It's a flat circle. We got to talk a lot about time. Before we talk about time, what do you want to talk about here in episode 100? I got a little thing. If you don't got a thing, what do you guys got?
It's been a ride.
It's been a ride.
It's been a ride.
It's been a crazy ride. I can't believe we are here. Danny, no.
Oh, Danny.
Danny really wants to pull my mic over.
Yeah, man, I can't believe we're at 100. It's really weird. I'm excited about what the next 100 looks like.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying anything set in stone, but I've put it out there a few times to the guys that I don't know where we are in the story exactly, right? But we're moving pretty fast, and there's some arcs that I might just decide to skip. And my book, because I'm so excited to move into where we are now. The plot's really coming together. 100 episodes in, and we know what the plot is. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that exciting?
Right.
We're gonna figure it out.
well, you know, now that we're so deep into this plot and things are starting to come out, it would be weird to go do a pepper eating contest right now.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, I love what I mean?
I mean, I'd be down for round two.
Let's do it. Let's just do that.
Dave, you son of a bitch. Episode 100, and you still haven't learned.
But I was gonna say, before I silence my phone, maybe, just maybe, 200 will be the end of our show.
Whoa.
Maybe not long after. Yeah. I don't know. We could be 50% through this incredible story. I don't know. I'm blown away. I'm excited.
It's nice to like get a gauge, be like, okay, this is maybe sort of kind of where we're at. So if you listen to the first 100, I hope you stick around for the second 100.
And then who
knows what's after that? It's not like I don't think any of us want to disappear. So
I've got plans.
What happens after episode 200?
Plans. Stay posted on Discord, Instagram, all that good stuff.
We start our rap career after that.
Yes. gentlemen, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Clearly, this is monumental. This is very exciting. Everything we've been doing with the show has been such a wild, crazy thing. And we're like, we've got so much crazy stuff to do and see and experience. But I want to know in your personal lives, you know, because I'm thinking about how we're here. We're hitting the peak of our show. When did you peak? When did you personally peak in your life? What was your big moment?
That is I guess I'll let you know.
Yeah. I guess I'll let you know. you're wording it like it's already happened.
It has.
Oh, okay. Well, then you tell me yours.
I will tell you mine. Yeah. Oh, it's easy answer. The day of my wedding. Wait, it's not what you think.
So corny.
No, it's not what you think.
My wife's going to kill me for not instantly saying that.
No, hold on. There's a reason why it was so good. And it wasn't the wedding part. So on the day of my wedding, looking at my wife's eyes, she was beautiful, all that, cool. But anyway, as we're about to walk down the aisle to leave following the ceremony, I got to pick all the music. And I had the DJ play up the opening number, like the main theme song from Dragon Quest VIII. And hearing those trumpets blare, I had my friend hand me a cane. And I strolled down that aisle with a cane listening to the Dragon Quest VIII theme. And I have never been more cool.
Dude.
I knew you were going to say a game that I have no idea what the hell it is.
Dude, he always talks about Dragon Quest. You have to know what Dragon Quest is.
You don't know what Dragon Quest is. It's so good.
Yeah.
I love Dragon Quest so much. It's like my thing. I don't know.
I certainly won't call it my peak, but
it's not as cool as mine.
It was still pretty cool though.
Okay.
My wedding party walked to the RuneScape theme song.
Oh, that's right. That was cool. I was in that.
You were there. I was gonna say, I was like
that was really cool. That was really cool.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That was a good one.
Not my peak though.
Not your peak.
Peak. Jeez, Louise.
Yeah.
Criminy. I don't know. Jeremy, you next.
You've lived a really boring life. It's fine.
Yeah, I guess so.
You played checkers once. That was your peak.
Well, I think in a couple of years, I'm going to step it up to chess.
Oh,
or
shit.
Chinese checkers.
Oh, damn.
We'll see how brave I'm feeling.
Jeremy Wolf.
Well, it's nice to know that I'm doing a podcasts with two best friends on the decline.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I'll be the one to carry us forward because my peak's still to come, baby.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Be honest with the pants people.
Okay. Well, how about this? How about let's rephrase it a little bit because I have something that I think is pretty cool for me, you know, in my life, but I certainly wouldn't call it my peak. Give me like a life. Not even life-changing, but like a life-defining moment, like something that really makes you. Okay, I'll do mine first.
Yeah. I was turning my phone off.
Holy shit.
And I dropped it.
Have you guys ever truly, genuinely entered what they call the zone?
Every day.
You're going to have to be a little more specific. What kind of zone is this?
You hear athletes talk about it a lot. It's like when everything like slows down and you just like,
oh yeah, it's on Rocket League all the time.
Legitimately, I feel that when I DM sometimes.
Really?
When I'm really hot in a session. I'm feeling really good about it. And like,
and it's like, it's almost like an out of body experience.
It's like almost addicting when you really kind of feel like you're improvising and pieces are coming to you really well. And it's like the rare once a blue moon. I'm not a good improver, but like when it lands, it's amazing.
I think it's like love. I think it's like you know it when you're there sort of thing. You know what I mean? One time in my life.
Okay.
I was in the zone.
Okay.
All right.
I was a lad. Eighth grade.
Oh, I think I know this story.
Oh, you certainly know this story.
With a corncob pipe.
I was a student athlete, and I did track and field. And in eighth grade, every single track meet, I got second place to Zach. I don't remember Zach's last name or anything much about him, but I remember he was my frenemy.
If you're listening, my Zach, bitter screw rival. You.
Yeah, Zach from somewhere in southern New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Find him, people. And both Zach and I, who were at the sort of like top of the ticket, made it to our you know, middle school state championship.
Ooh. That's a big deal. That's a big deal, Steven.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. So it was my last throw, my last put, excuse me, nomenclature, words matter. And I entered this zone. Everything really like slowed down and it almost felt like I was like out of my body and everything just went perfectly. And I beat Zach.
Yeah.
It was great. It was nice. Fantastic.
The banner nice. With your name still hangs in our elementary school. Because you peaked in middle school.
See, that's what I was trying to avoid. No, I'm married now. I'm a homeowner. I just came back from this wonderful vacation. I'm doing cool stuff at work. I've got upward trajectory.
I'll never beat Zach again.
Fuck Zach.
With all that depression out of the way. Any other stories, any anecdotes? Do you want to get to our next peak?
Yeah, sorry. I took up like a bunch of time.
Episode 100. That was cool. It's a cool story.
What is it, like 25 minutes in?
We're 12 minutes in.
Oh, well, that's, you know.
We'll just call the Blanche scenes. We go for it. You guys ready for this?
Are we skipping over Jeremy?
Yes and no. What?
Well, I said, if you have any more stories, right? I gave you the option. Do you want to jump in?
No, well, cool thing? Okay, if Steven's going back to middle school.
Yeah.
Well, fuck it. I'll go back to middle school sports.
Sure, I know, yeah,
this doesn't have to be peak things. Like, I mean,
I'm going to pick on you, though, after you say it.
I was playing football in junior high.
You were a football guy?
That's surprising.
Begrudgingly, I kind of was like forced into it.
I'm just trying to imagine like emo band Jeremy.
Oh, dude, yeah.
Playing football too?
Yeah,
but were you still
I was terrible at it. I had no idea what the hell was going on.
You can't cross
I didn't know you had to memorize plays, so the coach would just say, hey, go out there. And I'd run out there and just stand there.
Cool.
Where'd I go?
Were you still like 6'9", though, at this time? Like,
yeah.
No, 6'8".
Just shy of pro.
No, this kid that would like bully me a little bit, we were playing against him.
Ooh.
And his team. And I saw him running at me. And I'm like, shit, he's coming for me. I'm like, but I'm going to come for him.
Nice.
And I got in the zone, fucking leveled him.
What was his first name?
No.
No? You don't know his first name?
No, I'm not going to say his first name.
It was Zach, wasn't it?
Yeah. Zach from, where was this time?
Chicago.
Wasn't Chicago at this point, right?
Michigan.
That's right. Yeah. Zach from Michigan. We're coming for you.
Was that, did you say Jack and Zach at the same time?
Is that wrong?
We don't know what his name is. Covering two bases. Gentlemen, are you ready for this? I want this to feel like a season finale of sorts. It's going to be a little narrative. We're going to do some fun stuff. We're going to close the loop on some of our backstory threads, I think. We're going to have a lot of fun. And we're going to see what comes next. But first things first. Imagine, if you will, an image of the Radiant Citadel. A city standing upon a twisting serpentine fossil. A fossil far larger even than any of its enormous kin we've seen throughout the world. And wrapped around a shining diamond. Around this structure, 24 colorful gemstones orbit, locking into a never-ceasing dance. Only halting their movements when they are called to port to dock at the passage of respite that makes up the head of this fossil. Beyond all of this, an ethereal mist drifting away into a vast nothingness. And beneath the citadel, the keening gloom, the dark roaring clouds of an endless storm building into a vast cyclone from which nothing can return. Lightning cracks against the storm wall, and the pit that makes its center seems to drop off far into black eternity. we look upon this image. And because this is Hollywood, baby, we hear a voiceover.
Time is a cyclone. Its wind obliterates all, drying oceans and grinding mountains to dust. Its rain washes all, rinsing all worlds clean of memory and history and truth. Its lightning burns all, and no being, even a god, could survive the wrath of the storm. Yes, time is a cyclone doomed to revolve and repeat in a circle, perpetualized by ignorance and giving way to a vast spectrum of horror and pain. A cyclone that can tear worlds apart, scatter their fragments, and then, in the discerning gaze of its eye, pull them together anew. What is that old adage again? The one with the butterfly and the hurricane? I quite like that one. The implication it carries that all acts, even small acts, can mark the beginning point of their own storm, their own story. Of course, it would take a great many flapping butterflies to truly build to the howling winds of a hurricane. But is that not true as well for most grand stories? Is there ever just one beginning?
And imagine now, if you will, a great fortified shrine at the edge of the sea, showered by the dark gray clouds of a weeping sky. Perhaps you see these sort of shimmering black walls, a grand sort of archway gate that slowly creaks open. We are on the world of Umizu, the reigning world, this grand sort of island nation surrounded by endless water reaching ethereal borders. And we're going to zoom in just outside the shrine as this door slowly opens to a figure, perhaps huddled against the rain, waiting. We see Blanche Trudeau, a very different Blanche Trudeau, I imagine, a Blanche Trudeau at the start of her journey, her change. Much like the aforementioned butterfly, this Blanche has yet to enter her cocoon. Blanche, describe how you look here in this moment.
When Blanche first arrived at Umizu, she was younger. Not young. I think in her 30s. Plainly dressed. Calloused hands from working. But she has the same sharp eyes with hope and determination. She's excited to have arrived here. It was, I imagine, not easy to get here. And she's eager to meet Ozan.
A true fish out of water. This is, I believe, your first time ever leaving your world, or possibly even your pool.
The pools. Yeah, certainly.
Wow. Truly far traveled. And I can't remember if you mentioned it, but Blanche, we know, at the end of her time with Ozan was in her sort of middle-aged years. How old is Blanche now, as she's about to meet her future mentor?
I feel like Blanche is in her 30s now, maybe her later 30s.
Okay.
She's looking to start a new adventure, or any venture at all, really. And starting late. She's got a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah.
If she wants to be an adventurer.
With that eagerness, we see Blanche looks up, excited, as the gates to the Shrine of Storms opens. You know you are not allowed to go in. Nobody is allowed to go in here. You see a number of warriors stand perhaps at the front of the gates, or maybe just behind them as they open, wearing a similar garb to what we saw with Ozan. Sort of black, sort of samurai-like armor, cover to a helm, mask. They do not have the lightning bolt style horn coming up from the closed off eye, missing eye. And you can make these comparisons very easily, because between two of these guards for the shrine, you do see the storm eye. Once a guard here himself, the lore states, begins to move out the gate, kind of maybe laughing, he pats one of them on the back and kind of laughs heartily at something. He's sort of stepping into the mud, splashing up onto his shining armor. He doesn't seem to care at all, and he's sort of moving forward, and he perhaps stops very suddenly. and his one eye, one true eye in his mask turns and takes in this figure that's been waiting for him.
Oh? And who might you be?
Man, how do I do, like, not old Lady Blanche?
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm Blanche Trudeau, and
ooh.
I'm here to deliver my intentions to be your student.
You can't see much behind the mask, but you get the impression that the eye is smiling.
Oh, deliver them yourself. Now, why would you do that? I believe I requested that you simply have letters delivered to me.
Well, I knew you would get many letters, and I hoped not few delivered in person. And she produces a letter from her pocket and reaches to hand it to Ozan.
I think his hand sort of slides forth, and he's...
Now we must be careful. There is an implication that perhaps I spurred you to break the laws of our conquered worlds and smuggle yourself somehow into the world of Omizu, which, of course, I would not intend for that as some form of test.
Small, like, laugh as he takes the letter.
Well, God, I kind of want Blanche to be a little bit playful. I kind of want her to try to, like, sleight of hand, move the letter out, you know, as he tries to grab it.
Go ahead.
Like, just kind of show him that she's got, I don't know, some spunk or something and some skill, maybe.
Roll d20. I'm going to say you have a +2 and I have a +6.
Okay, cool. So that's a 14.
It's a 10.
Whoa, me. Yes! Yeah, she looks cool! I wanted to do something cool! So as Blanche, like, flicks her wrist and moves the letter aside, she says, well, if you won't ask how I got here, then I won't tell.
I think... Just a long sort of pause, this appraising eye kind of scans you.
It is very interesting to see one of your kind here. Tortle of the Golden Bay. From my understanding, your people never leave your region, let alone your world. How curious.
I got bored of fish and thought that maybe fighting would suit me better.
I have found that those with sharp minds grow easily bored. And I can see that you have a sharp mind. That's very good. A blade well sharpened can cut through any foe. A mind well sharpened can cut through any problem. You can imagine that the latter is far more versatile. Come, let me lead you to the grounds of our dojo. You are accepted, of course.
Got it! I knew it.
And he doesn't even, honestly, like, you had, you're holding the letter, and he didn't take the letter.
Sure,
and
okay, he doesn't care, yeah.
He doesn't care. Yeah. He realized being here was perhaps all you needed to do.
Yeah, the test.
And, like, just, you're showing here, he's just impressed. This may be a man to whom words mean very little.
Actions over words, sure. Which is great, because I was a little worried. I was like, I'm going to hand this guy the letter. And David's going to be like, ooh, what does the letter say?
And then, guys, he's starting to, like, he turns. And somewhere, like, far to the east of the Shrine of Storms, would be like, you see, like, rolling sort of hills build up. He sort of gestures way out to maybe, like, the small, like structures, like buildings, not far from the shrine, but not really on the same property of it, where Blanche is going to spend many years eventually with others, too, including our buddy Amirath.
Amirath.
As he begins to move that way, I think you hear, like, the Shrine of Storms gate starts to close. Perhaps you look over. You maybe in the moment before it closes, you hear, like, a sound of rolling thunder emanating from the shrine. But it's strange, because the sky, while weeping, is not a stormy sky. It's just a light sort of gray haze. Your eyes may turn over there, and Ozan sort of playfully spins around.
I'm afraid you can't go in there. Very, very few are allowed. Important dignitaries may get a pass. And I myself used to work as a guardian of the shrine, a great honor, here in Omizu. While I do not currently hold that title, it is still a place of greater reverence for me.
Kind of looks back at the door, sort of musing to himself almost.
One day, perhaps, I may be chosen as keeper. and be allowed knowledge of the shrine's innermost sanctum. But I would not be allowed to leave the shrine after that. Not until my death, so I'll hold off on that for a while.
We gotta get to that shrine. Imagine the secrets held within.
You did say your name, correct? I believe he...
Yes, she introduced herself as Blanche Trudeau, yeah.
Come, Miss Trudeau. And he kind of gestures and begins to move with haste.
Yeah, Blanche follows Ozan, you know, her head's going left and right, taking in the sight.
I can tell this is going to be a lot of fun for you and for me. I've had little personal experiences. It's been rather daunting all these years as a luminary traveling about, meeting so many but building few true bridges.
Yes, and in addition to learning much, I hope to have much fun. Have any others arrived yet?
You are, in fact, the first. Though I've received many letters.
And there's like a pile of junk mail. Like, yeah.
We cut to his room and it's just, yeah, literally just a trash bin full of letters. Yeah, all of them, letters. None of them are open.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, you may reward yourself the honor of being the first pupil of the Storm Eye.
Damn, that is so
cool.
Oh,
shit.
He's some music again. He just does this a lot. You kind of know this in his time. He's just very, like, wanders. His mind wanders, and he has to speak where it goes. Like, it's like the wise mentor, but he can't shut up.
And it's a skill in its own to, like, keep up and, yeah. You know, as the conversation changes.
He's, like half jogging while speaking to this calm voice, and you're kind of going to keep up with him. Yes, the Storm Eye. It's a very cool name, isn't it? Though I do have one single reservation about this title. I've heard it said they call me the Storm Eye because when I arrive in a crisis, the crisis is at its end. All danger past. Now, the sentiment is quite sweet, but, kind of turns a sort of wagging finger. Any Umizan sailor could tell you how incorrect that description is. For the storm will hit again, and it will hit with force. Its true wrath withheld for its second coming. So you see.
And then he's fully running. He's jogging backwards now. Gesturing towards you.
When you find yourself in the eye of the storm, in the false calm, you should not relax. You should not celebrate. Rather, gird yourself. Speak your prayers. For the worst is yet to come.
Never let your guard down otherwise.
Yes, yes. My apologies, I've gone off on one of my tangents. I tend to do that. I dare say you'll get used to it.
I think this may have been our first lesson.
The first of many.
I think he stops very suddenly, skidding in the mud, splashing kind of up behind him. And he actually bows to you.
Whoa. Okay, Blanche bows lower.
His bowing form just kind of shakes another like this laugh. And maybe in this moment, maybe we see these two bowing towards each other and we pan away from this. We pan up and up and we pan through time, through many years of harsh training, through many years of a close kinship, a friendship being built. And I want to jump ahead to a different time, to a different world. Perhaps to an older Blanche Trudeau, fresh from her training, standing on a beach of white sand and looking towards an arena of stone. Perhaps you've just heard word, maybe a relative sent you a letter informing you that Master Defense, or the current Master Defense is leaving his post in the Golden Bay. And this next tourney will likely lead to the choosing of the next one.
Yeah, so this absolute nobody, you know, past her prime, sort of just lady from the pools, shows up to compete.
As you stand upon these sands of this beach, as you look towards this arena, as you hear trumpets blaring and see turtles all around you moving towards it, many of them looking like fierce competition, fierce warriors. Does Blanche perhaps say or mutter or think anything in particular?
as her eyes focus on the prize ahead.
Yeah, she's very singular. At this point, you know, she's fresh off her training, so she's just sharp and focused within, and doesn't really care about her opponents. I guess it doesn't really matter. There's no sense in worrying about it. She doesn't know who they are. They don't know who she is. She just has that one singular drive to win.
Hell yeah.
To finally prove herself as something.
Here we see Blanche Trudeau push forward towards that Colosseum and into our story. Now let's go somewhere else, somewhere a little less sunny. The Tower of Authority, Pillar of Authority, I can't remember which one it was. The tower belonging to the...
I'm pretty sure it's Tower.
Tower of Authority, we'll go with that. The Tower of Authority that looms over the city of Cerule, over the world of Tythos, has many floors. And there are quite a few that have these grand, grand empty chambers that seem to just like fade off into blackness, almost like these vacant spaces themselves are meant to state something about the sheer power of the LaRoche family. We're going to cut to one of these where we hear a bellowing sort of laugh. Perhaps we hear the sound of like ringing steel, ting, ping, 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 and then koo, a blunted sword biting into maybe like a light suit of armor, maybe no armor, maybe just cloth and flesh. We cut to an image of Jules LaRoche getting knocked backwards, already looking quite beaten, quite bloody. As standing above him, we see Jacynth Kellig, a younger Jacynth still training, but quickly becoming one of the most loyal of the LaRoche men. We hear a voice just say,
"No, no, that's enough. I think my son has learned his lesson. Haven't you, boy?"
As we pan to Jules, we see Jules at this point in time is early in his 16th year. Now, in prior scenes, as a reminder, Jules, late in his 15th year, some months before this, was led to his mother's office high, high, near the top of the tower, where his palm was pressed into the nail of this fossil, a black wax sort of dripping into his hand, sucking down, becoming a part of him. This agony that lasted for days seemed to leave his hand, felt like it was on fire, like it was tearing apart. But in the aftermath of this, Jules, you gained some abilities. Abilities that nobody's aware that you have. At this point in time, you have access to invisibility and inflict wounds, your shadow-touched features. Innate power given to you from the demonic elements that have been placed into your blood. As you perhaps sit there, sort of beaten and bloody, behind Jacynth, you see a very kind of, putting on a very stoic face, but with just the most trace amounts of just like wanting to step forth, wanting to just like wring his brother's neck. Dresden stands there, sort of at parade rest. And Dresden, too, not long before this, also gained an ability. Some fragment of fossil embedded in his back, a wish to see Jules protected. These factors combine to create this echo that he can summon and create, move around at will. And perhaps in these last few months, the two of you have been planning. Justin kind of moves back.
"Yes, I think he learned his lesson well. Didn't you, whelp?"
Sword slides back in.
Shit, I didn't practice Jules' younger voice.
"Yeah, sure."
He just kind of smirks at that, and not even realizing the sarcasm. He just kind of turns away, sort of grinning.
"Well, well, I suppose. Ah, the boy is late to meet Zavar and his mother. Who will take them? Who? Come now." And a number of like hands sort of go up. I think Dresden and Jacynth kind of line up. A few other guards move forward. I think four in total. "And the rest?
will carry me. I have grown quite hungry.
Like a bunch of figures moving around. So
he's like a pig.
Yeah, he's moving through a throne that like they have to carry around. So they kind of reach the end of, reach their rod jutting out and kind of lift him up with a heavy sort of, and he kind of,
Move along then. I'll see you later for your next lesson, boy.
And you watch your father's ruddy face grinning as he's turned away and led sort of one direction in the darkness. I think maybe he's going one way, you're going the other. You know that there are elevators. Your father, you have the magic elevators here, which is kind of the direction you're going. Your father always says they make them feel kind of motion sick. So he's going to have the guys carrying up the stairs.
Oh my God. Jeez. I hate him so much.
Nice. The banquet hall is 15 floors up. So,
I mean, to be fair, I did this. I said this is how he is.
You created this monster.
So I think you see like two guards step in front. You see Jessen kind of grabs you very roughly by the arms, yanks you up, pushes you kind of like behind them. Dresden sort of stands up beside him. The two of them are kind of behind you. Jessen behind your left shoulder, Dresden behind your right. Two other figures in armor, their silver armor, their blue and white tabards. And they begin to march you down this sort of, through this long pillar-filled black sort of empty chamber to where it opens into an elevator shaft. And I'll just keep asking you, because I don't know how this is going to go. This is your game plan. Do you make any moves here, or do you go into the elevator?
Sorry, I'm opening up D&D Beyond on my phone because I might need it.
Okay, interesting.
Okay, describe again where we're at. Exactly.
So you're in this large, very dark, sort of dimly lit chamber.
Okay.
Huge pillars lining this room from like front to back, kind of vanishing off into obscurity. And you are moving towards one of the walls in this chamber where there's a door set into it that leads into this okay. small circular chamber. It's basically an elevator where there's a stone floor that magically just moves through. It's like this grinding. You can hear it sort of grinding down as it kind of moves into place.
And outside of the door behind us, what's just outside that door?
Essentially.
Outside of the chamber.
Essentially nothing. Yeah, just like father's being led one way.
Hallway, room, like. Describe the layout of what is outside the door behind us that we came in.
This is all in one grand open chamber. There's no like other rooms. You are here, kind of getting your regular training sessions with your
right,
father.
Right. So how did we get into the chamber then?
Elevator.
That same elevator that's coming down.
There's an elevator on one side and there's stairs in the other, far apart.
That's what I'm asking.
Yes.
That stairs.
Your father and his guard are moving there.
Okay. What's beyond the stairs?
Anywhere. A path to any floor. This is basically just one huge... This entire floor is just this one grand, open, empty room. The LaRoche family does this. Almost like having these... your father loves to kind of surround himself. Like seeing this massive space that could belong to anybody, belonging to him and being used for nothing, just delights him endlessly.
Needless opulence.
Exactly. Literally, the two ways out of this room are the stairs he's taking and the elevator they're going to take you up.
Okay. Okay. Describe how each character is laid out.
Jules is in the center of four figures, right? Okay. Imagine if you mentioned a 5-foot grid. Imagine the dots on a five on a dice. Does that make sense?
Okay.
That is the most needlessly...
Yeah, Jules in the center. There's a square of four guards around him.
Exactly. That's a better way of saying the thing I was saying.
Okay, and where are Dresden and Jessen?
Dresden is behind you on I think, your right shoulder. Jessen is behind you on your left shoulder. The two other men in front of you are guards. You probably know their names. I don't. They're Amos and Bigsley.
Okay. Give me 1 second.
Okay.
Okay, I'm gonna try to explain this as best I can.
Okay.
What I want to do.
Okay.
This is all happening simultaneously. Does anybody have his hand on Jules?
No.
Or is Jules just in the middle of them?
Just in the middle.
Just in the middle.
Yep.
Okay. Jules casts invisibility on himself.
Okay.
What's the reaction from the guards?
I think the first thing is you're over there and you you basically say something out loud, like they whisper an incantation as you kind of touch yourself, or just touch, you touch yourself. Gross. you whisper something, and I think you just kind of hear Justin say,
"What is that, Prince?"
Something wrong, and you just vanish. And he's, "What? What?" He just screams. The guards in front spin around, looking around.
In that moment of realization, Dresden will manifest his echo behind Samuel and the others that are carrying him, and will have his echo deliberately run under him being carried, knock over a couple of the guards, so everything collapses as a distraction.
Oh, so, just, yeah.
So what he's doing, and his echo is just going to continue up the stairs until he's 30 feet gone, it disappears.
Okay, so you're like...
So what I'm hoping is that the guards will see Jules disappear, see this commotion over there, and think that Jules has run that way.
I love that. I will say, like, so you're just barely moving. The stairs wouldn't be close to disappear around, but you could easily have the echo could, like, move under them as they're just moving away.
I mean, because
go behind a pillar.
Yeah, exactly.
And gone.
Exactly. They're not going to be looking directly at that area immediately when Jules disappears.
And they said it's dark in here.
Exactly.
Hell yeah.
So, and then, yeah, that's.
What is this? Samuel just yelling, "Help! Help! Seize the boy!" His guards. Drop him a little bit. No! And they kind of start running. Justin spins around. No! Starts running after you.
And as all of them run, Jules is getting into the elevator, and so does Dresden.
He goes with?
Fuck no. That would be way too fucking suspicious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Fuck.
I mean...
I didn't think that far ahead. Oh, no.
You're invisible. If you get in there alone, that might be it.
I'm invisible, yes. Dresden turns around as the other guards are going and says,
"I'll try to head him off at the main entrance."
And Dresden also gets in the elevator and they go down.
Okay. And Dresden rarely talks. So this is like in this moment.
Oh, yeah,
like,
that wasn't young Dresden. Whoops, I'd never practiced that. Yeah.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. So he yells and he runs in. Boom. You begin to slide down. No one questions that. The elevator begins to descend quite quickly. It's probably like some sort of spinning kind of mechanism. You kind of crank to whatever floor you want to go to, and it begins to follow that.
So now I have a question of what does Dresden know? So does Dresden know what to expect on the first floor when this elevator opens?
The first floor is... again, quite open. It's the floor that, if people are coming in to like dignitaries might come in and they might stay on the first few floors. So it is unbelievably like opulent. There's just like furniture, pretty well cluttered. This floor is actually more structured. There are rooms and carpets lining the hallways between them. But when you get off this elevator, it will basically just be a beeline right down this long sort of hallway between various offices and whatever like guest rooms.
Okay.
And it will lead to the front. There'll be a good number of guards, but these guards are not expecting invisible Jules.
Okay, so we'll go all the way to the first floor.
Okay. Sets.
And the elevator opens, and Dresden walks with haste toward the front door.
People look up, kind of curious, seeing this, maybe like, Dresden's not supposed to be here. There's some haste. Excuse me.
And he recognizes that.
Anybody see anyone come down here?
No, sir. No problem.
Are you sure?
No one.
And he walks to the front door, and as he's saying this, he opens up the front door, steps out to the front, knows that Jules is coming around inside of him, and he looks around, like looking for somebody. And he turns around and says,
"Fuck!"
One of the gay guys is kind of, "What's happening? What's that? What's going on?"
"Be on the lookout for Jules LaRoche."
"Shit, Jules? Oh, we're fucked, aren't
we?" "He's somewhere."
Head up. Everyone's kind of turned around like, "Double up with the guard on each exit. Jules does not leave. Cerise's orders. Jules does not leave." Everyone kind of like lines up. People start swarming around. Perhaps barely like figures that are moving from like, towards the gate, barely like almost nudge Jules. Just kind of sliding his body one way or the other to kind of get between them, kind of locking up behind Dresden. But the door is still open and Jules slides out. I imagine there's a moment as Jules steps onto that first step, the light of outside like bathing him, that he looks back and Dresden knows that he's looking back, and unbeknownst to Dresden, but maybe he feels that the two lock eyes, because as Jules is about to go and meet new people and go on new adventures, for this plan to work, Dresden must stay, must misdirect and feed information to you and commit himself to perhaps a lifetime of solitude.
I also think that was the first time he spoke in a very, very long time. Like, I think maybe that was the moment that he decided to start speaking again, because it was so important.
He has a job to do now.
Yep.
That job requires him to use his tongue. The silver tongue of Jules LaRoche isn't there to back him up anymore. He's on his own now. And perhaps then there's one final nod shared as Jules turns, leaving perhaps the greatest friend in the Concord worlds behind to watch his back from the shadows of the tower. And here, I want to montage through the events that follow the next few years. Not long after this, evading the guard and living on the streets, having a hard time adapting to life outside of his prison. There's a day where Jules, after a barely successful attempt to steal some bread, gives it away. And in his hunger is offered another piece. Meeting a young boy who had soon become his closest confidant and guide to the city, a young Chester.
Hey, Chester and Jules, right?
Jules and Chester.
And for 2 years it was. Evading guard again, just playing it safe. Jules swiftly learning the ways of the streets. The two of them running games and pickpocketing, finding dry places to drink and sleep and laugh. With Dresden's help and his friendship carrying on through notes and misdirections, you survive. And where you feel the absence of that first close friend, you do forge this deep bond with this new, younger companion. Perhaps there's a day, again, like 2 years after their first meeting as they're moving through the streets, and you're assailed by two figures who just, boom, jump out from an alley before you. A portly young boy and a sort of lanky, awkward elf, a dwarf and an elf kind of stand before you and then sort of waving a little, I think the elf you see is waving this like very obvious fake kind of wand, like he's about to do something real magical and crazy. Their faces are both covered in like a cloth and you just can't hear,
give us all your books and notes on magic.
Books and notes? We can't eat books. We're agreed to roll them down for food. Food, Fibro, get it together.
Right. Fine. Give us all your food then. And if you have any books, I'll trade you some food back for the books. Right?
Fibro. You see young Mulligan and Fibro. From maybe the worst muggers in the city.
Just a bunch of little criminals.
Little criminals.
It's my share. I'll give them my share, Mulligan, okay?
Oh, well, that's fine then.
So I gotta give you a book or food?
Well,
which one you want?
Well, first you give us, hang on. Oh, first, you give us food.
Okay.
All your food. And then okay. I'll give you back some of your food, but for any books you have. So it's an even sort of trade, because books are pretty important.
It's a good trade. You should do it. What do you got for food?
Okay, well, how about they give you these rolls?
Okay, yeah, you'll give us those rolls.
Waves a stick at you.
And there you go, you can have them.
Yeah, that's how, this is good, this is easy.
Yeah, it worked better than I thought.
Kind of maybe like, the young fiber star reaches out for one. He has like a little bag, like this leather satchel that like one of the very worn straps just snaps. And the satchel opens up and a bunch of pages of like magical notes just spreads in the cobblestone streets. And,
nah, beans!
He reaches down like snatch them up.
No, wait, hang on, just don't run away. We're gonna figure this out.
Nah, I got you. And then Jules bends down and starts picking up the sheets.
Well, I guess I can trade you back your food for my own magical papers.
Nah, you can keep it. Jules, sounds like you need it.
Jules, don't tell me you're getting attached to these guys. They're idiots. Jules, come on. It's Jules and Chester, don't do it.
You can see something in your eyes.
And you see, like, hearing that, these two look up at you and maybe like their scarves kind of fall over their mouths and they kind of awkwardly and they just... You can just see these two very, very
pathetic right now. Like you're like, these two will not survive another week on the streets.
Chester, all I'm trying to do is what you did for me.
Oh, come on. That's not fair. You're the prince, right?
No.
Oh, right, of course. We don't talk about the prince. But you are the prince.
We don't talk about the...
Oh, sorry.
I'm Jules.
Fibrosis. Fibro's better. I don't know why my name is that.
I'm just going to call you Fibro.
Not Mulligan. Mulligan's Fulligan. At least you wish he was.
Hey, Molly.
I'm hungry.
Yeah, here's another roll.
Oh my god. You see like my hands shake as another two more companions join your little group, your cherry delights, your new small family. And for another 4 years, these four work together until one fateful night where their stores were raided by a half-orc child. We saw that story.
You can torture me all you want. I won't tell you anything.
And with Miskin sort of joining the ranks, your family grows even larger. Perhaps we move 1 year beyond that meeting with Miskin. One day when the full crowd's in the streets, Miskin obviously kind of sneaking around, scouting somewhere ahead, hiding under ladies' skirts and wherever he can find. Not in a weird way. He's just good at hiding.
You said it.
You made me.
Band of armed robbers and perverts.
As they're kind of moving around, maybe discussing jovial what they're going to do this day, you hear like a voice ring out. Hey, you stumbled into me, you did. Didn't even apologize. You little runt. You guys look up to see, and you're coming to know this now, that in this city, there are two kinds of people. Those who stare into the despair that they face every day and push beyond it and try to make the place better, try to make the city better for everyone that lives in it. But there are also those who give in to this despair and try to dole it out twice as hard to anyone they see. You see some large, like, mason be like, staring down at this one, like, small child, like, this dark-skinned boy who doesn't really, like, he's almost like maybe fallen over. Like, you get the image, he ran into this guy, then fell over, and the guy's now yelling at him. And another very young girl sort of runs out, sort of dives out on top of the boy and just, no, please, he doesn't mean it. He can't speak. He doesn't really talk. It was an accident. We promise.
Accident, I'll show you an accident.
Kind of like raises foot out to kick.
Jules runs over.
And yeah, he just kind
in
of...
In between.
You know, he stops dead as you kind of step there. You're standing there behind, you know, in front of this young boy who looks up with wide eyes. This young girl who stands there. Maybe as you're kind of doing your thing, you feel in their presence come right behind you or right beside you, Chester taking a spot. Kind of glances back at the girl, glances back at you, puffs out his chest a little more like he wants to look cooler. Yeah. You better back off, buddy.
Jules just stares him in the eye.
Don't do it.
What? Think I'm scared of you little runts? I think I'm terrified.
And then Chester looks at you just, Jules, say the thing.
Say the thing, Jules. I don't know what that means.
That mean, David? What the fuck does that mean?
I don't know. I got in the moment.
All right. Jules gets all intense.
Oh.
Looks and says,
the thing.
And the guy holds his breath waiting for something to happen.
I don't know what you want from me, David.
I don't know. I have no idea.
Yes, and?
You feel two more presences come up beside you as you're kind of like staring this figure down, Fibro, Mulligan, each taken aside, and finally popping up somewhere from like down low, Miskin, the Cherry Delights, forming ranks, the two newest members kind of staring on the figure. This man kind of looks around, realizes this maybe isn't worth his time, and sort of storms away, and your family turns around. Chester kind of gives you a look like, oh no, no, not again, as he sees that look in your eyes, sees the look that they share. This Chester. Small child, Paul.
Chester, come on. There's room for everybody in our family.
All right, well, welcome to the Cherry Delights.
After that, Jules will lean down to Jeans and Paul, and he'll look over at Paul and say, what are you going after?
eh, kind of gestures up. Maybe there's like a, there's a guy on the corner, right? Maybe like who has like a guitar, who's like singing or just, you know, playing a street thing, which, you know, kind of street bum that sort of has a case in front of him, people filling it. It's barely anything inside. You can see he just wants to be near the music.
He loves music. He's Paul. I'm James. Thank you. It's been rough lately. The two of us been together for a little while, and I don't know what happened to his family.
What you talking about? Where are you family?
And this sort of reserved smile kind of breaks out. And the boy just looks up at you. His wide eyes that look both blank and yet so full of depth. And he just says, family. And perhaps here with your family gathered and merely a year, the last of your crew, Round Stuff will be found in one of your stores, hungry, willing to accept your hand. And some years later, the storm will set in the skies of Tythos and your new adventure, your story will begin. And with that, let us return to our story. Return to where we last left off, in the preserve of the ancestors, surrounded by this tropical salt marsh, looking out into this glistening sea that ends upon a wall of diamond, cascading waterfalls flowing into it like some sort of great fountain, and bursting from the water here, this Bastite Caiman, a dawn incarnate formed by floating sort of stones, this mossy green with streaks of red, this creature with the sound of through echoing thunder somewhere emanating in the air around it, this oppressive gravity seeming to just, what's the word here? I already said emanate.
Put forth.
There we go. Seem to be putting forth from it. I don't know. I don't care. It's Columbus week. I'm very tired. This thing thunders onto the sands.
A new luminary, come to greet me. A useless gesture. You luminaries do what you want. No one cares for the will of the incarnates now. Speak your peace and let me rest.
Great Caiman, if you hold so much distaste for us luminaries, then why do you meet us?
Because it is one of the few things still expected of my kind.
Cocks a giant gemstone head.
Another turtle. I met one of your ilk recently. He was quite rude.
I am sorry to hear that. I'm not all that surprised, though. What was expected of you before that is no longer?
We would guide and dictate. We would choose the speakers. We would steward your words to the proper place. But let us not dwell on matters that no longer exist. You have long since left the control of the incarnates. Only one amongst your speakers has respect for us now.
They can still exist. I seek your guidance now. Will you give it? Will you answer my questions about our world and the origins of it?
Thunder emanates forth. You feel like that gravity sort of pressing down on you, almost pushing your feet a little deeper into the sand beneath you.
What questions?
How did the incarnates come to be? Did it happen that 1,000 years ago?
I can speak not of these matters. The vows hold.
Can you speak of before this world? Can you speak of Shadra Khan?
Gravity again. Boom, pushing. You feel like your back sort of almost bend a little bit.
You. What do you know of Shadra Khan?
We know. Struggling against the weight. We know about the serpents. It was their world before ours.
Yes.
It's fractured now.
Yes.
And if
this
some
was our world.
I knew it! I fucking knew it!
You came to us from your other worlds, you tiny mortal beings. You came and you stayed, and we came to love you. We led you, cared for you, protected and served to see your every need satisfied. But your tiny minds could not stomach satisfaction. You turned a jealous eye towards your own, found disgust in even your most minute differences. You armed yourselves with tools of steel and magical arts, and you killed. And because we loved you, your war became our war. Your hatred poisoned our kind. Drakon clashed in the skies, wet crimson tears. Countless souls drowned in the blood of serpents. We gave you our world, and you soaked it in death.
The gravity around you begins to sort of lessen, as if this great weight just lifted from your backs.
Great Cayman, I seek to provide an ebb to this flow. If we don't find some way to work together, whatever is left of our world will be, well, it'll be gone.
We are aware. We are the stewards he left. But you are not ready. You are farther and farther every day from ready. You cannot be united, else the war will come again.
Who is he? What war?
Amongst us, Drakon, there was one who many would call our king. A being of vast size and power, dwarfing nearly all others. A being of incomprehensible wisdom and heart, whose true name is too great for your ears. The mortals would know him as he who parted the cloud and night and threaded the light of dawn to the sky. Now the echoes of his deeds have granted him the simplified title of the Sun Weaver. It was he who formed the plan to save Shadra Khan. It was he who found the immortal diamond and imbued it with his immense power, whose body now wraps around the diamond, a base for your city, and whose soul lingers ever below.
Soul lingers
Holy
below?
Holy shit.
Do you mean the Keening Gloom? Why can't I do Blanche?
I'm Blanche Trudeau.
I'm Blanche Trudeau.
Yes, you should have introduced yourself.
Steven, you are Blanche Trudeau.
No, I just like, I couldn't, I got out of it or something. Do you mean the Keening Gloom?
Thunder roaring out, almost like you feel approval in this, as if this is the sound of a nod to this thing.
Is he pulling the worlds back together?
He used the diamond as a focus, breaking Shadra Khan and binding the pieces ever, forging a means of indirect communication through the worlds, a means to build relationships and garner peace. It cost our king his life, and caused the death of nearly all of our kin, whose souls remain trapped within their bones, most gone mad after centuries of lingering death. We can reunite. It is his eventual will. We incarnates, we were the Drakkar most loyal to the Sun Weaver, one for each civilization of our old world. We came with him, removed from our bodies and granted these avatars of stone. We are his eternal stewards, set to watch the fragments of our worlds, judge their people. And when the time is right, it is our responsibility to bring Shardrakan back together.
From what world does the turquoise incarnate represent, and why did they choose Sholay?
We all chose Sholay. The turquoise represents Ankarin Sengar. Time had passed, dangers had grown. We knew we must enact the plan. Create a bridge, a safe bridge between the worlds. Sholay seemed the most efficient option. Ruthless and just. We watched all worlds, but she was the one we called upon to be our champion. 250 years.
And who chose Artash?
Artash!
If the Sunweaver is dead...
Because you asked that, I'm going to go back. I was going to, like, cut the scene, and I'm like, shit, that's a pretty cool question. It's a really cool question.
The angel appeared only 50 years ago from a plane of radiance connected to Ankarin Sengar. I believe he served a different master before, but he was awed by the Radiant Citadel, by the glory of our king. He took for himself the moniker of Hand of the Sun Weaver and made it his quest to see our lord's wishes fulfilled. Shardrakan connected the world at peace. He came before all of us incarnates offering his aid, but he is arrogant. He could not tolerate our patience, and now views us as traitors to the Sunweaver's will. He knows nothing of us!
So Artash is, like, trying to force the peace. Huh.
I got the question, too.
Who are you?
This is Spin Sour.
You know who I am.
Yes. This is my valet. No, I'm just kidding.
He looks up, brief pause. Zomate Shab. Where did they come in all this?
You are hit with such a powerful force of gravity. I think the two of you almost fall over. The two of you almost like
shit.
Bow, almost like fall, collapse to your knees.
Six on the die.
Blanche, you literally do.
I just wanted to roll a die.
Your knees, you have old knees. It hurts. You kind of fall into the sand.
The great betrayer. One amongst our kind that nearly matched the size and power of our king. His true name will never be uttered again. But you would know him as Zomate Shab. The first to spill the blood of fellow Drakkar, he spurred on the war, both yours and ours, driven mad by a twisted love for his subjects. His creed to see all peoples freed from our salvation. During the time of war, the Sunweaver defeated the betrayer, tearing open a hole into the abyss and sealing him away. Over the millennia, I believe he has been changed into something monstrous. But Even now, he can only return to our world through avatars of his creation. Avatars like you! Like, feel him. Feel his presence.
I'm not gonna let that happen.
Luckily, we vowed not to kill.
Whoa, did this dude just say that he would have killed you if not for this
Sounds
vow?
Like it. Sounds like it. Don't worry. I'll kill him for you.
I have one more question. And Blanche looks to Jules, knowing that this question, I mean, you know, asking about the demon lord is obviously very hard, but maybe this is a different kind of hard, and Blanche wants to do this for Jules and just hear David make this voice more.
My throat. My poor throat.
What do you know about Calypsonia's mate? Dude, his eyes. Dude, did you just see the pure panic in his face?
That is interesting.
Open mouth. Wide eyes.
It's actually interesting. You might expect from my reaction the gravity to push down on you harder, the storm to rage louder. But instead it seems to fully ebb. The gravity almost pulling away. Like you are feeling this effect of no gravity for a half second. This thing almost like...
Recording diamond.
Alarmed. And I just say those words, like, I think you have this moment of inspiration, you say that, but I'll say, like, after you say those words, it's already starting to flood away from you. If you pull out the recording diamond, it is not working.
It does not work
in these presence of these things. It wouldn't be working this entire time. He's revealing truths that cannot be known.
Okay.
But this thing, it almost, like, it's surprise, sort of steps back. This incarnate takes a step back. And as you say, like I said, you had this moment of inspiration, but those... That line, though, that the thought is already starting to flee before you. Like, in this moment, before this thing, you could feel it.
She, like, already forgot the question that she just asked.
And it fixes you with its pastite eyes. And you hear a strange humming alarm suddenly just ring out. Emanating from all around and above you, the crystal ceiling, which is projecting an image of a cloudless blue sky, suddenly shifts to a deep, pulsing red. The incarnate turns from you, looks to the sky, and you hear it moan out.
No!
What are your initial reactions here?
What the fuck? Kind of like that. Wow. Blanche's initial reaction is...
Something's happening.
Is to leave.
Are you leaving?
Blanche looks to Jules, like...
Jules is just staring up. Just a blank, almost defiant expression.
Her face washed in red light. Blanche, perhaps you turn, understand that... Something is happening. Perhaps action must be called for. You spin and you hear one last sort of roaring voice from behind you.
It is happening again!
And now let's let our mental screens return to our original image. Because time is a cyclical cyclone and shit. The radiant citadel hanging over the keening gloom, and we see now the entirety of the world diamond has taken on that same shade of pulsing red. And because this is still Hollywood, baby, we hear another voiceover. This one an echo of lines spoken to a young, or not so young, Tortle many years ago.
I've heard it said that they call me the Storm Eye, because when I arrive in a crisis, the crisis is at its end. The danger passed. Now, the sentiment is quite sweet, but...
And we cut to the streets of Saint-Étienne, to a busy square in Fiesta Town, where a giant projected image of Storyteller Orin furiously gestures, speaking to the populace, to every populace, warning them with wide and tearful and terrified eyes. Beneath the screen, shining with a radiance of his own, we see Speaker Artavazda, the blue-skinned Pari angel right hand to Atash, speaking solemnly to a crowd of terrified onlookers. Gabriela Cortez, Dance Macabre, stands amongst them, looking for all the wards like she is ready to drop into a fighting stance. Her dark eyes reflect the speaker and celestial, and they narrow.
Any Umizan sailor could tell you how incorrect that description is. For the storm will hit again, and it will hit with force. Its true wrath withheld for its second coming.
And we cut to Nuari, to a banquet hall in Zinda, where Jean Franklin and Ledoux Montelio watch Orin's printed image as well. Their mouths hang open, their hands firmly interlocked. The makings of a dinner party surround them and their hosts, Margus and Zenia Ruba, as well as Amos and the recently revealed Larissa Neer, stand in shock at Orin's words. Harlan Burnshadow stands beside Fyodor in the back, the two men looking grim and sickly.
So you see, when you find yourself in the eye of the storm, in the false calm, you should not relax. You should not celebrate. Rather gird yourself. Speak your prayers. For the worst is yet to come.
And now I want to take us back in time before the meeting with the Bastite came in, before the diamond shifting red and the humming alarms and the terrible news that swiftly spread throughout all the Concord worlds. And I want to take us back to Umizu. We look upon the Shrine of Storms once again, now many years older than when it was first seen by a younger Blanche. But it is largely unchanged now. And here, as we linger just outside the gates of the shrine, perhaps on a beach of dark sand where low waves crash against the shrine's black walls, we hear a different alarm. A sound akin to many sets of ringing glass chimes. Ting! Perhaps we hear a scream escape the walls of the shrine, a brief and sharp, "Pirates!" Ah! And we see, standing on this beach just outside the grasping waves, Dresden Kellig and Crispin Dubois. It seems that Cholet's intel was good. Events are transpiring just as she said they would. You never saw the assailants enter, yet the Shrine of Storms has been taken. And it is up to you two to take it back. And I know you have, like, no context yet about what's going on with these guys. But do you want to say something cool?
No. Even better. Backshot of Dresden and Crispin. Standing side by side. Between them, you can see the gates, and Crispin just reaches up a furry little fist for a fist bump.
Fucking action heroes!
Well, yeah, of course, Dresden fist bumps back.
You can't do it, but hell yeah, hell yeah!
Dresden's arm slowly moves up just a little bit because Crispin's short as fuck.
It's true.
Yeah, it's reaching, like, above his head.
Yep.
Oh, I love that.
Gives him a fist bump.
We see this. Boom. Our camera focuses on that. And as you get to work, our camera zooms back from this, these bumping fists. Farther and farther from Dresden and Crispin, and from the shrine until our screen lingers on a nearby hilltop that overlooks this entire scene. And here the ringing sound is quite faint. Faint enough that we, the audience, can easily hear the sounds of armored footsteps approaching. Ch-ching, ch-ching, ch-ching. Followed by a familiar voice.
Ah, I had suspected so. Very clever, Cholet, but I'm afraid you have only forced my hand in this.
Ch-ching, ch-ching. Ozen Yoshikatsu steps into our screen. We see the black armor of his Kabuto helm shine beneath the golden light of the curving lightning bolt that rises from his mask. His long silver hair and beard sway with a suddenly rising wind. His hand gently and grimly hovers above the handle of his katana. The skies above, already gray, begin to darken as Ozen looks down upon the Shrine of Storms. A low, rumbling sound mingles with the ringing chimes. Sound of thunder.
First, the fall of Tythos. And now, Umizu's time has come.
And we'll call it there.